Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Economist Emily Oster is all about the numbers and how those numbers intersect with major parts of life. She's written two books. One of them in 2013 was Expecting Better, Why the Conventional Pregnancy Wisdom is Wrong and What You Really Need to Know. And then in 2019, there came Crib Sheet, a data-driven guide to better, more relaxed parenting from birth to preschool. So maybe they're following landmarks in Emily's own life. So now, with her kids in school in the middle of a pandemic, Emily Oster, who's with us at the moment. Emily, I got to ask you, what big data set did you turn to in order to decide whether or not your kids should go back in school or go to school remotely?
You know, so thanks for having me. I have spent a ton of time in the pandemic looking at evidence on kids and what's happened with kids, but there actually isn't a great data set that I could say, oh, that's the piece of data that I looked to make this decision, which of course is what I think is frustrating for so many of us, because the question is, I have no idea what data to look at. It's not really there.
Yeah, that's the only right answer, right? Because otherwise there's some magic data set in the sky.
Right. Unfortunately, I can't tell you about it, but it's amazing.
So Emily Oster is a professor of economics at Brown University, and I've mentioned her two previous books. We're going to talk a lot about how we find that data to handle life better, make better decisions in this pandemic. But Emily, tell me, so your kids are back in school, right? I mean, are they going to school in buildings?
Yeah. So my kids are back at school in person. They started last week, full day. They're both in elementary school. And, you know, I think for us, we thought about the levels where we live. We live in Rhode Island. It's, you know, the pandemic is very under control. And we thought about the kinds of precautions the school was taking. And we thought about the value for our kids, which we thought was really, really high. And in the end, you know, it seemed like the right choice, even though I think we all had this sort of moment when you drop off, which is like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm doing this.
Okay. So walk me through in a little bit more detail how you came to this decision, because I mean, obviously there are millions of fellow parents who are trying to weigh the pros and cons. I mean, it sounds like you used a combination of the data you had available, namely infection rates and probably some information from the schools itself, plus like your own values. How did you find out how to balance all those?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the first piece is that in general, infection rates in kids have been low, and kids seem to be, they get less sick. They seem to be less susceptible. It doesn't mean they can't get sick, but in general, the data is very reassuring about kids. So we spent a lot of time with that. I've spent a lot of time with that in the last few months. And then, you know, we spent a lot of time thinking about what are the things the school has put in place to keep the virus out, to prevent it from spreading if somebody were infected. So every kid is wearing masks, including my kid's school goes down to age of three. All of the three-year-olds wear masks all day, except when they eat. And, you know, and then we thought about how whether they had a plan to respond to the virus. And then, you know, we really thought about what can we do in our family? Like, what is realistic? And I think for us, the benefits of the kids being in school for both us and them were just really large. And so kind of weighing those costs and those, you know, those risks and those benefits, I think this was the right choice for us. Although, you know, I think not every parent is going to make that choice. And I think that's part of what's been hard, is that it's hard to recognize other people could make different choices and they could also be the right choice.
Exactly. And that, I mean, actually, that's one of the reasons why having reliable and high quality data matters even more, right? I'm just personally just curious. Are the kids being socially distant? I mean, one of the things I struggle with the most is I still have a hard time getting myself out of the visions I have of what school used to be like, right? And like, how is it working for your kids right now?
So I think this is like the biggest, in some ways, some of the biggest mistakes that we're making is that we have in our mind, and it's not a critical, I have it too, but like we have in our mind this idea of like, this is the way school should work. And like, it's the idea that I'm like my kindergarten, like they sent a picture and like, you know, there's a table and there are like plexiglass dividers between the like activity areas of the table. And there's a moment as a parent where you're like, oh my gosh, like here's this picture of my kid. They're all wearing masks. They're doing the plexiglass dividers. Like, this is so weird. Like, I'm sending him in his weird situation. But actually, people are really adaptable and kids are way more adaptable than you think. And the first day that my kid, my five-year-old, wore a mask for 8 hours, I was like, hey, how to go with the masks? And he was like, well, they let you take them off to eat. Like, he couldn't even believe I was asking this question. He was like, what's wrong with you? Obviously, you can take them off to eat. So it's totally fine. So I really think that yeah, it's a little weird. It's a little different. But I think that we are overstating how important it is for school or anything else really to look exactly like it did before.
Yeah. I mean, and also I love that your kid's like, well, the most important thing is I could eat. Like that was, he wasn't worried about sort of like the long-term social emotional impact of having the mask on for 8 hours.
It wasn't like how lunch. Is my language development going to develop? It was just like, I got to eat. Yeah. No, the biggest mask problem we've had is one of my kids got ketchup on their mask while they were eating.
I have to wash them every day because like I know exactly what my kids have had to eat because exactly. It's all over the inside of the mask. Okay. So what we're getting at here, though, is how people make decisions. And I appreciate you sort of walking us through your family's decision making here on a really big issue, especially to get back to the core of this conversation. Like, we just don't have a lot of great information upon which to make those decisions. So can you tell us a little bit about why that is? Why is it that even this far into the pandemic, regarding this major social good that is education, it's kind of hard to figure out what's working, what's not working, where there have been maybe additional infections, et cetera. Like, why is that information lacking?
I think there's a couple of reasons. So I think one, so you sort of, if you step back and you say, what would we really like to know? We would like to know when schools open, what happens to cases in schools, what happens to cases outside of schools, are there precautions that schools are taking that make this safer or less safe? So I think that's what a lot of parents want to know. Like, if I send my kid back, should I expect everyone in the school to get COVID? Almost no one in this school. Does it matter if they're wearing a mask? Does it matter if they're potting? So there's a lot of questions like that I think we would all like to say, okay, I can point to this data about what is going on. I think the reason we don't have that is that schools have not been open. I realize that sounds sort of like facile, but one reason is just we haven't opened schools. Almost nothing in the U.S. stayed open in the spring. We have some data from Europe, but the circumstances in Europe are very different. The school systems are very different. So I think it's a little hard. We learned something from that. It's a little hard to learn everything we'd want from that. And then you can say, okay, well, why haven't we, there's actually a lot of places where schools have been open for like a month. Mm-hmm. So in Tennessee, schools have been open for a month. In Georgia, schools have been open for a month. So there, the question is, why don't we have that data yet? And I think that's a little bit of a sort of breakdown of some, federal data collection effort. So I think we should have been in place to collect that data. And some states are, and they're starting to kind of put some of it out. But we should have had a federally organized data collection effort for this that was going to be ready when the first schools opened to be getting this kind of information and be putting it out there immediately. And we just weren't. And I don't know how much of that is that school districts are, very decentralized, and how much of it is that it's a lot of private schools and that's very decentralized, and how much of it is that, people weren't interested in this information. I'm not sure which of those things is the problem, but the result is that we don't have what we need, even when we could have it.
Well, I mean, I think you're right. It's all of the above. Definitely, it would have been. Look, in another universe, we would have had a federal government that was interested in trying to at least assist in collecting this information so that states and municipalities could make better decisions, for sure. But I think the localism of education is a big part of this. I mean, even within states, there are differences, profound differences from district to district. So, I mean, I guess this is a long run up to getting to the point that you are working on, with many other people, a COVID school response dashboard, Because what is this dashboard?
Yeah. So the dashboard, which I'm working on with, as you say, many other people, aims to kind of effectively do this thing that we think that should be happening, except, you know, try to build it up from the ground up from individual schools and districts. So we're asking schools and districts to enroll, to enter some pretty basic baseline data about their opening plans and their how much enrollment and staffing they have, and then to follow up with them regularly, like every other week, to ask them about COVID cases. And we're going to put this up in a public dashboard by the end of the month, so people can look. You know, not so much to look to see what's happening in my school, because mm-hmm. I think this data is going to be anonymized. You won't be able to look up your individual school, but to ask in general, when we look at elementary schools that are open, you know, what do the rates look like? And then we've asked some questions about things like masks and potting. So you can look and say, okay, among elementary schools that open in areas with low prevalence or medium prevalence, does it matter if there are masks or not? So I'm hoping we'll learn some sort of generalizable things from this, if we can get people to enroll. So I hope everybody gets your school to enroll, or gets your district to enroll. But I think that there are kind of a lot of the data collection efforts here have kind of come from the ground up, and I'm hoping that we can contribute there, and then we can help districts decide when it is time to open and people decide when it is time to send their kids.
Yeah. So for school leaders who are listening and may want to participate, we've got a link at onpointradio.org to Professor Oster's project here on creating this COVID dashboard for schools. But let me just get you to explain in a little bit more detail, Emily. It's not just what are the infection rates or where have there been outbreaks? It's the confluence of that information plus what schools are doing, whether they're public, private, parochial, to find out basically, are you looking for best practices or what's effective? How is this supposed to lead to better decisions?
Yeah, so I think that it is sort of looking for best practices, and I think that, you know, we're trying to kind of distinguish between, say, asking the question, if there is a case in schools, how do we keep it from going from one case to 10 cases? And are places with masks less likely to make that kind of transition? Are places that have potting less likely to make that kind of transition? So I think by looking over time at the same schools and having some sense of denominators and having this information about reopening, I think we can sort of put that all together and hopefully do some actual analysis and sort of put out and say, okay, you know, here's the kind of safest way that we mm-hmm. see places opening.
Well, we're talking this hour with Professor Emily Oster. She's a professor of economics at Brown University, about why we need good data to make good decisions. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking today with Emily Oster. She's a professor of economics at Brown University, co-founder of the website COVID Explained. We'll talk about that in a second. And currently, she's working on a COVID-19 school response dashboard that's attempting to gather data on school reopenings around the country. And by the way, if you're a school leader who wishes to participate in the dashboard, we've got a link to how to do that at onpointradio.org. And Emily is also author of the previous books, Expecting Better and Crib Sheet. Now, Emily, if I may, I just want to It's very easy to say woulda, coulda, shoulda, right, with the federal response here. But in terms of gathering data about COVID and schools, I mean, it is a novel virus. This is a novel pandemic for the world. Did any country do this better in terms of having the right information or better quality information before trying to reopen their schools?
So not really, although I think some places did better in terms of collecting data as they were opening. So the UK came out a few weeks ago with some data. They actually had some schools open in June. So I think that they kind of, they locked down, they closed schools, then they reopened. And so then they released some data before the fall reopening about what had happened in the summer when they were open. So I think that was an example where they actually, like, they had the data, they had some data to do some decision making, and I think many of these European countries have done a bit better than us, although, you know, probably not, still not perfect.
Mm. Well, I just want to play a little bit of tape for you. This is from July, when the White House press secretary Kayleigh McEnany was asked what President Trump would say to parents who were having to juggle kids, work, and remote schooling. And McEnany said that schools in the United States should reopen. And then she added this.
Yeah, the president has said unmistakably that he wants schools to open. And I was just in the Oval talking to him about that. And when he says open, he means open and full, kids being able to attend each and every day at their school. The science should not stand in the way of this. And as Dr. Scott Atlas said, I thought this was a good quote. Of course, we can do it. Everyone else in the Western world, our peer nations, are doing it. We are the outlier here.
Emily Oster, respond to that.
God. So first of all, just the idea, like, we shouldn't let the science stand in the way is sort of exactly the opposite. We should let the science guide us. And it's not that I necessarily think it's wrong to have some school reopens. I actually think that we can do this well, but the idea that somehow we should do it in spite of the science as opposed to with the science is a little bit crazy. I think it is true that all these other places have opened more than we have. I think it's also the case that our infection rates are very different. And so, you know, we were talking about opening schools in, you know, in places in the South a month ago where the infection rates were very high. It was a very different virus situation than they were seeing when they were doing this in Italy or in Germany or basically anywhere else in Europe. So I think this is part of the reason it's a little bit hard to learn from the European data about what we should do and what is the safe way to do this.
Right, because the contexts are very different. So yeah. to that point then, in the data that you're trying to gather for the dashboard, for the school's dashboard, how are you and your group going to try to assure that the context is also part of the information that people can glean from the dashboard?
So I think we will, I mean, the sort of shortest answer is that I think the most important piece of context is community rates. And that's something that we can merge in to the data. So we can let people cut the data a little bit by, you know, are these places in areas with high, medium, low infection rates. And I think that's an important piece. I think the other really important piece of the context is age of kids. And so actually some of these European countries titrated with respect to age of kids, opening for the youngest kids first and then for older kids later. Some of that has happened here too. We can, you know, look in the data and see, you know, elementary schools versus middle schools versus high schools. So I think those are the kinds of cuts and sort of context that I think are probably most central to people's decision-making.
I'm just going to say that no matter how dismal the news gets, I will always take a moment to pause and congratulate someone on the brilliant use of a word. And hearing you say titrated in that context just, like, made my day. And now I want to figure out a way to get the word precipitate in there somehow. But
exactly. So much science.
Okay, so Emily, hang on here for just a second, because obviously anything that has to do with COVID and schools is of deep interest to our audience. So we have On Point's Dori Scheimer with us, who's been keeping up with the conversation on social media. And Dori, what do people want to know?
Yeah, there's so many people asking about so many different kinds of decisions that they have, and we'll get to some of those. But first, we had some users on Twitter asking about another kind of choice when it comes to school, which is parents making a decision to send their kids to private school who were at public school because those private schools are able to be in person in their local public school has to be virtual.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this is something that a lot of people are struggling with. So I will say my kids go to private school, but the public schools in my district are also opening in person for younger kids. But I think for a lot of people, there's a feeling of like, am I abandoning my local public school to send my kid to private school? I'm somehow choosing between the values that I hold around, you know, feeling like I need to sort of be supportive of the enterprise of public schools. And yet, you know, I really need my kid to be in person so I can go to my job. And so I think, you know, this has highlighted a lot of the inequities around education that have come up in this space, that a lot of kids who are not in school, who are struggling the most with distance learning, who don't have access to internet, you know, those are the kids whose districts are not opening. And I think that's been, you know, we're going to see a really widening of inequality as a result of the pandemic that I think will be hard to recover from.
Mm-hmm. Dory, do you have another one?
Yeah, one more from Damian Williams on Twitter. What do we do when the data is there but goes ignored by those in institutional power or is presented in ways which seem maybe intentionally misleading?
What do you have a sense of what they mean?
Yeah, I have a sense, you know, maybe colleges that are going back despite cases rising in the city or the community that they're in, the data not necessarily matching the decision that they're making.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's been very hard to make these choices when people feel like the data that they're getting is not transparent and which they maybe don't understand all of the pieces of data that are coming together. And in which some cases, like the data does seem to be hidden. And so people, you know, some colleges have been reporting very transparently, some haven't. Some districts have been reporting very transparently, some haven't. And I think it's left people feeling like, you know, what are you not telling me? Is there something terrible that's not being revealed? And somehow, you know, it's hard for me to trust anything that people say.
So actually, Emily, this is a great way for us to just pivot briefly because you're a professor at Brown University. And if I have this right, you're co-chairing Brown's task force on reopening?
Yes. I did. Yes, that was what I did.
I'm not sure what to make of your tone there.
Yeah, no, I did. I did it. And now it's sort of ended because now we're reopened some.
Well, so it's one of the few Ivy League schools that's actually bringing people back to campus.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we worked really hard to try to figure out how we could do that safely, but also recognizing that, you know, this is the best thing for our students in terms of learning and for our, you know, faculty and community in terms of kind of being together. And, you know, we're testing, we have a lot of resources that are probably not available to school districts. So we're testing everybody on campus twice a week. In like a giant building. And, you know, we're doing a lot of other things to make sure people are safe. But I have to say, I'm very excited that we're able to bring a lot of the students back.
So if
it really feels differently.
Well, if we're talking about the need for good data and making these decisions, how did data factor into how Brown made this decision?
I think a lot of our data was really thinking about, you know, how can we de-densify the residential life? That's a big piece for colleges that doesn't come up for schools, but it's a big piece for colleges is how can we make sure people are living sort of like in a way that is not right on top of each other? And then how do we make sure we have enough isolation and quarantine housing if people do get sick? How can we make sure we have enough testing? What is the right amount of testing? You know, how can we do enough testing that will really like keep the infection rates very, very low?
Mm. And you were able to get all this information.
Yeah, we were able to sort of do our best. I mean, like, it's a new virus. I mean, as you said earlier, like, it's a novel virus. And so the answers to these questions are all basically unknown. So the question of, like, what is the right amount of testing? Well, we have some models that can inform that. But we can't say, okay, here's the college that did it twice a week. Here's the college that did it, you know, once a month. Here's the college that did it once a week. Which one was the right answer? So we're kind of using models, triangulating in some data and trying to make the best choices, understanding that there is always going to be a fair amount of residual uncertainty.
Right. So residual uncertainty, but that residual feels like the baseline for how life has been like since roughly the beginning of this year, but definitely since March. It doesn't feel residual at all. I mean, that to me, that's one of the one of the defining features of this pandemic is that it has made uncertainty the norm. So can you talk a little bit about in a sense, like one of your attempts to push back against that uncertainty, the website that you started called COVID Explained?
Yeah. So COVID Explained, we started early, like sort of early in the pandemic, and it's together with actually a bunch of like real, as I call them, real doctors, real science people. And the idea there was really to help people understand some basic stuff about how the virus works. And so I think that, you know, at that time, it really felt like a lot of people like almost didn't understand things like, why is it important to wash hands? Because you sort of have this impression like, well, if I touch the virus, then it just gets in. And sort of helping people understand, no, the reason to wash your hands is because actually, if the virus is on your hands, it's not just going to seep in, it needs to go to your nose. So if you wash your hands and it doesn't get into your nose, then things, then, you know, you won't get sick. And so we actually, like, the first thing we wrote there was something called the path of the virus, which is just literally a post about, like, how does this virus work? Like, what is a virus? How does it have to get in? What happens if you get it? And so the idea is to take the kind of some pretty sophisticated science and try to explain it in a way that helps people understand why the precautions that they are taking might be useful, and, you know, what kinds of precautions are really necessary. And so we have, you know, we have a lot of stuff on kids, which is obviously partly because of the stuff I do has become, you know, a big piece of what we have. But also, you know, there are posts about testing, trying to help people understand the differences across different types of testing. We have posts about, you know, wastewater and whether it's really useful to screen people's poop for COVID. So it is really to explain COVID, as the title suggests.
And the answer to that last wastewater question is yes, right?
I think our experts were mixed. We have like a little expert conversation about this. I think people were mixed on how useful it is. It depends a lot, I think, on what the kind of underlying prevalence is in the area. It's a good leading indicator for a low prevalence area.
Okay, so about experts being mixed, though, in their views on the utility of certain data, Emily, this is actually an important point, and I didn't anticipate it coming up in the context of wastewater. But I mean, but data is a thing without meaning until we assign meaning to it, right? And so, especially for something like a novel virus or this particular pandemic, I mean, how are you handling, let's put it back in the schools context, how are you handling what the different interpretations of the information that you're trying to gather might be?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I've been trying in a lot of the cases of sort of data in this, when I put out data, when I try to generate data around this, when I try to talk about data, I've been trying to focus a lot on just saying what the data is. And I think that, you know, it's like, here is what the numbers are. And rather than saying here's what the numbers are and they are small, or here's what the numbers are and they are large, because I think part of this is, you know, people kind of need to use the muscle of figuring out for them what these numbers mean. Because when we talk about these risks, it's not that the risk is low or not low for any individual. It's like there's a combination of what is the risk and what is your interpretation of that data. So I think that, you know, part of what's been hard is that people want to interpret evidence as either saying this following thing is perfectly safe or the following thing is not perfectly safe or is totally unsafe, as opposed to saying, you know, there are some risks to this, but maybe they're small based on other risks you're taking. And you kind of need to evaluate this with your own lens. I think people find that hard.
Yeah, well, absolutely they do. And especially in a sort of in a situation where it seems like the ground is constantly moving underneath your feet, given the kinds of massive uncertainty that a pandemic brings, it's understandable that people kind of want to know, like, should I be doing X or should I be doing Y, right? They want certainty. But the data don't, like you just said, it doesn't necessarily give people that uncertainty. It doesn't tell them what to do. So ultimately, I mean, is there a limit to the usefulness of gathering all these data?
I never think there's a limit to usefulness of data, Magna. That's my, like,
I set you up for that one.
It's always useful. I mean, look, I think that, you know, we, you, Yes, I think we have to recognize it's not going to give us the answer, but it will give us a way to frame the questions that we're having and inform them. And you know, something is better than nothing. And I think, you know, with something like the schools example, I think there are definitely people out there who are working under the assumption that, you know, if my kid goes back to kindergarten, there's like a, you know, 80% chance that they're going to get COVID in the next 4 weeks. And I think that's probably not supported by the data. And so there probably is some data that could be helpful for that person in framing the choices that they're making.
Okay, so let me put it this way. Isn't there evidence, though, that ultimately, no matter what the data say, people tend to only listen to information that confirms the decisions they've already made or the biases they already have? Like I'm just there's a person who's just going to be scared and wants to like be in a bubble all the time, they'll absorb all the data that affirms that, or the person who says, I don't need to wear a mask, I'm going to go out and have my pool party, and they will absorb the data that seems to affirm that. I mean, I'm just wondering, honestly, what difference does it actually make when it comes to people's behavior?
So I think that there are a lot of people who are in the middle of those. I totally agree that those two camps exist. But, you know, when I was working on like childhood vaccinations, which I think a lot about for my books, you know, there are definitely people out there who are like, I would vaccinate my kid no matter what. Why are you telling me? Of course, I'm going to vaccinate my kid. And there are people who are like, I would never vaccinate my kid. And I'm going to look out there for all the data that would suggest that that's unsafe. But there are actually a lot of people, even in that place, even in that setting, where people are kind of in the middle. And where they've come to me and said, like, I don't really know what to do. And like, thanks for like helping me understand the risks and benefits. I think there's even more people in something like COVID where people just don't really know what to do. They don't actually have the information. And so giving them some data has some value, even if the people on the tails aren't going to be influenced by it.
I would agree. I mean, that's why we do this show every single day, hoping to give people good information. So folks, hop over to social media, Twitter, Facebook, we're at On Point Radio, and let us know what kind of information do you need to make the best decisions that you can in this pandemic. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cuneo was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country. But it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Emily Oster. She's a professor of economics at Brown University. And we're really trying to take a big picture look at what kinds of good data do we need to make good decisions in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, whether those decisions have to do with day-to-day life. Of course, there's the issue of schools and reopening schools, anything and everything. How can good data help make those decisions? And where do we find that data? Emily is also co-founder of the website COVID Explained, and she's currently working on a COVID-19 school response dashboard with several other people trying to do exactly what you're talking about, gather data from reopenings around the country. She's also author of Crib Sheet and Expecting Better, two books from 2013 and 2019. And On Point's Dori Scheimer is also with us, keeping track of people's questions and comments on social media. So what are people saying, Dori?
Meghna, Krista Dunn on Facebook said that some members of her family are having a harder time than others with being apart from family and friends. And she says it's hard to weigh the risk of getting them some in-person socialization versus the potential depression resulting from the isolation.
Okay, so you might have information, the data, but how do you weigh the risks?
Exactly.
Yeah, so Emily, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what's really hard here is that it probably the first step is to kind of recognize there isn't going to be really a good answer to this. So both of these answers have risks. They both have benefits, but they both have some risks. And I think in some ways that seems facile, but recognizing that I think has often helped people move forward, because we're kind of used to expecting that when we make a decision, we will feel really great about it. Like, okay, that was the right choice. I think that often doesn't happen here. And so you have to like move forward knowing, okay, this was the best decision I could make in this tough situation. I think in that particular question, really probably the first step is to ask, you know, how can I mitigate, you know, can I mitigate risk? Is it possible to see this person outside? Are we, if we're all wearing masks and we're kind of sitting outside in a distanced way, that's a very low risk activity, which could have enormous mental health benefits. I mean, I think one of the things many of us didn't recognize is just how valuable it is to see other people. And when we started reopening a little bit and even seeing other people for like a walk or sitting outside, it was like, oh my gosh, I really missed human contact. And I think we may have underestimated the mental health costs there.
Mm. Dori, do you have another one?
Yes, we've got a lot of people are struggling with these decisions right now in all sorts of different parts of their life. So Jessica on Facebook talked about having to leave the restaurant industry that she worked in for 35 years, saying that, you know, the data about the risk that she was facing going to work, just she couldn't justify that. So I think there's some question here, like, okay, you make the decision, and then what?
Yeah, and then sort of it feels like there's like you've made the decision, then what are you going to do next? Are you going to go back? And I think particularly the restaurant industry has been so heavily affected here. And there are so many people who have sort of lost their jobs and are now kind of finding themselves needing to figure out, you know, what is the next thing? And I think that it's not easy to think about when would I feel safe going back?
Mm.
So, don't have a good answer there.
So, Emily, I just want to take a step back here and remind folks, so you're a professor of economics. And economics, being the dismal science that it is on the one hand, it's a practice that loves to immerse itself in data sets to draw out conclusions about human behavior. But then also it has succumbed to the pitfalls of presuming that you can predict human behavior based on data. So can you tell me from your economist lens, like what is an economist doing trying to put together these data sets about schools?
I mean, you know, I think of economics as really kind of a science of decision making and decision making based on data. And so I think a lot of the questions that we face here and the questions we face in the rest of our lives are really about kind of like how do you structure a decision and then how to use data to inform it. So, you know, when I've been writing a lot about these choices in COVID, I've sort of often told people, okay, yes, the data is valuable and let me try to help you put that together. But the first step in a lot of these choices that people are making, I think, is really to define what is the decision that you're making. So to really say, like, what is the choice? So for the person who just asked the question about, you know, seeing some relatives, you know, is the choice, do I see them now or do I see them in 2 weeks? Is the choice, do I see them now or do I wait for a vaccine in, you know, a year? Is the choice, do I see them now in this way or do I see them now in this other way? So I think we're framing the question in too vague a way where it's, you know, do I see them now or something else? And we really need to highlight what is the other choice that you might make.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of thing I think economics is really is sort of good at, is saying, okay, well, you know, when you're doing decision making, we're deciding between A and B. And you kind of need to know what A and B are in order to make that decision.
You need to know what, but yes, you're right. You need to know what A and B are. But what we're seeing with COVID is that people are having to make decisions in an information poor environment. I mean, to your point, yes, they don't even know what B is. They may not even know what A is.
No, but you can always know. That's the thing. The A doesn't require, knowing what A and B are doesn't require you to have the information. Figuring out their risks, it requires you to have the information. But if you say something like, you know, should I send my kid back to daycare? There is something else you would be doing with them if you didn't do that. I think a lot of people frame that question as, should I send my kid back to daycare or not? As opposed to, should I send them back to daycare or should I hire a nanny? Should I send them back to daycare or should I stay home and, you know, leave my job? And I think actually saying, what is the other choice, which is something for which you don't necessarily need additional information, or at least you can say in the short term, what would you do otherwise? I think that is very useful for people because it gives you something concrete to compare.
Respectfully, I would say people are actually going through the other options in their heads, and maybe they don't want to talk about it that much because all options basically seem bad.
Yeah, no, all options seem bad. And so I think people start this and they're like, oh, all these options are terrible. Let me just stop and forget about it and just do whatever. But of course, doing whatever, that's also a choice. Just doing what you're doing is also a choice. So I think that, you know, this is a really hard set of things to think about because everything seems seems like a terrible option. And we have to somehow force ourselves to kind of keep making those choices, even though they all seem really bad.
Okay. So can you tell me then a little bit more about how, again, as an economist, you see people making decisions between a set of terrible options where one or two of them aren't demonstrably advantageous to them. I mean, I think that this is a real issue that like people are having to choose the best amongst the worst options. And it's not at all an easy thing to do.
No, it's not. And I think part of what makes it hard then is actually what's making it even harder is that when you finish this and you've made this choice, partly because these choices are so difficult and there aren't any good choices, we are often making different choices than other people. And, you know, not because one person's choices are right or wrong. Part of it's about preferences. Part of it's about, you know, maybe my read of the data is a little bit different or my understanding of my personal risk preferences are a little bit different. I think that even once people make these choices, what makes it particularly challenging is that then other people are, you know, kind of judging you for the choices. And I think that we kind of need to dial that down. We need to dial that down a little bit, and we need to just practice making choices in this setting. Maybe it'll get easier as we do more of it, but it's really, I mean, it's also worth acknowledging. It's just a really hard time for a lot of people.
Yeah. I mean, and understanding or the changing understanding of our personal risk preferences, I think in sort of regular person speak, that's I don't think this feels good anymore, or I don't like that option, or this is not something that I'm willing to do. I mean, I don't mean to oversimplify it. I do think that that is the level at which, and it's actually kind of a profound level of like core values and a sense of safety and certainty and how people want to live their lives that they're engaging in all these decisions with. And it's exhausting. I mean, we've had to like reassess every one of our decisions. I mean, have you felt that
fatigue?
Yes.
I mean, it's like all of these things that I would never have thought about, you know, like, I mean, so my kids, I said that at the open, like my kids are back at school, but of course I also have parents and, you know, we like to see our parents and we used to having a thing where like the only constraints on seeing them are just like, when can we find a weekend that is convenient? But now, you know, it feels very much like we're sort of choosing, should the kids be in school or should we see the grandparents? Should we pull them out of school the week before Thanksgiving so we can get a COVID test so we can see the grandparent? You know, like all of these things that are just constantly like that's in your mind all the time that you never thought of before. And I think the decision fatigue is it's real.
It's real. The struggle used to be real. It's still real. Now the decision fatigue is also real.
Decision fatigue is real.
Dory, you've been patiently listening in here. What do people want to know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're capturing a lot of what our listeners are feeling down to church. David Taylor on Facebook wrote us a long message about this struggle that he's feeling about whether or not to go back to his church now that it's reopening, because he feels like there are a lot of elderly people there and doesn't want to, you know, unknowingly spread the virus by going to church, and is frustrated that the church isn't just saying, we're going to stick with Zoom mass until the pandemic is over, and putting people in this situation where now there is a decision to make. So I think to you, you know, what would you say to people who are now being forced into new decisions as things start to reopen and continue to reopen?
Yeah, I mean, I think partly it is, I think that it's this sort of same kind of, you have to try to make the decision, you have to try to make all of these decisions in that particular situation, you know, again, thinking a little bit about, you know, how much can I protect? How much can I protect other people? You know, can I wear a mask? Can I stay distance and so on? But, you know, I think there may be a little bit of kind of, we need to limit the number of decisions that we're making at any given time and how much mental space we give them. Because, you know, as you say, that there are so many things you can be making new choices about at any moment. And I think it is overwhelming in a way that makes people unhappy. And so there may be a point at which you just say, like, I'm going to make this decision and I'm just going to try to move on.
Mm-hmm. So Emily, last week we talked with author and executive Margaret Heffernan. She has a new book called Uncharted, and it really takes a look at how we cope with uncertainty. And we talked about how good data or lots of data ostensibly can help people deal with uncertain or information-poor environments. And that led us to a deeper conversation about big data and the kind of almost godlike stature that the public and definitely tech companies can put on big data. And I just want to play a little bit of what Margaret Heffernan said.
You know, I do think that we have this rather fairy tale idea that somehow with enough knowledge and enough data and enough technology and enough machinery and enough surveillance, you know, this can all be mastered. And I think that not only is that just a fib, I also think that putting all your eggs in the tech basket actually amplifies the risk because it means all of your systems depend on one thing. And that is a recipe for disaster.
So that's Margaret Heffernan. We spoke with her last week. Now, Emily, I want to just make the distinction that she was talking about big data and tech. But she was also getting to the idea that there does seem to be, I guess, at least this popular belief that if we have enough data, we can know what the right decision is. And she says that that's leading us to a false sense of security. Do you think that there's the risk of that in the COVID era?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that people have gotten sort of more interested in data, which, of course, I think is great. I'm very interested in data. But I also think that there can be this moment of expecting the data will provide you an answer and not recognizing that any given piece of data definitely won't provide you an answer. But even all the data together, most of the time is not going to say that for sure one choice is good and for sure one choice is bad. And that's not only true in COVID. I mean, that's always true, although it's particularly true here. And so I think because people have this sort of, I don't know, fetishization. I'm not getting any points for that word.
Fetishization,
people are,
yes.
Yeah, of data, you can get into the realm of kind of expecting it to deliver in ways that it simply cannot. And I think that has led some of the ways we talk about data to be sort of like, here's this tiny study of 17 people, and therefore it proves that gyms are great. You know, gyms are totally fine. And like, that's not really, you know, that's kind of not how evidence works. And I think that we can be over-reliant. We can be over-reliant on data.
Yeah,
for sure.
That's learning how evidence works is a really important skill set that we all need to continue to develop. Dory, I'm going to give you one last crack at it.
Yep, we've got one more. So that's perfect. Coach Gale on Twitter says, data helps our decisions in all sorts of decision making. If weather forecast says it's 80% of rain, I'm going to take an umbrella. If the virus positivity rate is high where I am, I'm going to wear a mask and social distance. So why can't we have levels of virus danger that are more easy to understand, like red, orange, yellow, green danger? Is it like a fire warning?
I think that would be awesome. I mean, I really think like an ideal, you know, I mean, I'll tell you what we do at Brown, which is that there's like a level one, level two, level three. They have colors associated with them. They are linked to like some very concrete metrics about positivity among students, about positivity among staff, about absences, about what is happening in the surrounding community. There is no reason that kind of thing couldn't be ported into all kinds of other settings and help people understand better, you know, how should you be thinking about the kind of how bad is the virus in my area? And we haven't seen a lot of places do that. I don't really know why.
Yeah, I'd also say though that there are limits to a color scheme. Maybe I'm old enough to remember when Homeland Security used to put out color alerts for terrorism, and for a while
we've been in orange for like two
forever,
decades.
Forever, right? So yeah. Again, like how we use the data ultimately.
No, and it's true. It's true that when you get into the numbers, then people are like, "Well, now we're going to be like a 1-2, and then we're going to be a 2-4." You know, it's like, well, okay, but then maybe you need more levels. If you're going to be having slash levels, you need to have additional levels. So there are limits.
Yeah, it's maybe it's cinnamon versus red versus, I don't know, cardinal red, who knows. But Emily Oster, professor of economics at Brown University, author of Crib Sheet and Expecting Better, and currently working with a group of people on a COVID-19 school response dashboard. Again, if you're a school leader who wishes to participate in the dashboard, we've got a link to how to do that at onpointradio.org. Emily, thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Dory Scheimer, thanks for bringing in the voices of listeners through social media. Thanks as well.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.